on us to marshal the forces of decency, the forces of fairness, to marshal the forces of science and the forces of hope in the great battles of our time.
Almost 2 years ago, Joe Biden knew that this would be his call to the country, a battle for its soul. On Saturday night, he issued that call again, this time as president-elect of the United States.
Our nation is shaped by the constant battle between our better angels and our darkest impulses. And what presidents say in this battle matters. It's time for our better angels to prevail.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today on Point, let's talk about what the president-elect said. He didn't say our better angels have prevailed. He said it's time for our better angels to prevail, meaning it hasn't happened yet. But let it be said, the machinery of American democracy worked, thanks to the good faith, nonpartisan efforts of election officials across the country. By both electoral and popular vote, the nation has picked a new president. But did election 2020 also damage American democracy? Did it make it harder for that democracy to work better? That's what we're going to talk about today. And we're going to start with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. He is now a professor at the College of William and Mary. He served in the United States military for more than three decades, including as chief of staff for Colin Powell. More recently, he was a member of two groups, the National Task Force on Election Integrity and the Transition Integrity Project. Colonel Wilkerson, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you.
So your thoughts today on this Monday after we have a winner, a president-elect in Joe Biden?
Well, in no uncertain terms, could I be happier with regard to what the National Task Force tried to do, which was help expedite and facilitate free and fair elections in America. The ceremonial part, the pageantry part, if you will, is over. That's the elections, the casting of votes. That's the people in the states who just did a magnificent job starting to count those votes and so forth. And now we have a victory speech, if you will, declaration by AP, Fox, and all the major networks of a president-elect. We have no concession speech, which is normal. It's customary for a concession speech, even at this early point. But that doesn't matter because now we're going on to the nitty-gritty part, the real practical part, where everything has to be confirmed, usually by about the end of November. Recounts done if necessary, and then on 14 December, Electoral College slates presented. And we have a mathematical certainty almost anyway that that will be Joe Biden.
So you're keeping your eye on the details of this practical portion that you're talking about. And I want to come back to that because the transition is where we must focus now. But I wanted to step back for a second, Colonel Wilkerson, because we've had you on this show a couple of times over the past several months. And the first time you came on, you quite frankly surprised me with all of the analysis that the groups that you had been working with had been kind of quietly doing about exposing the fragility of our electoral system, of our democracy, and sort of trying to game out all the ways in which things could go wrong. I mean, it was truly eye-opening. So first of all, in terms of the actual vote itself and the fact that there wasn't violence and that even though they were being so terrifically scrutinized, those elections officials across the country did their jobs. I mean, does that not give you sort of renew your faith a little bit in the workings of American democracy?
It does. And it reminds me of some of the things the more optimistic amongst us said in both groups during the past 6 months for one and over a year for the other. And that is, don't ever count the American voter out. And certainly don't count out those courageous in this COVID-19 pandemic, doubly courageous precinct workers who are going to do the gut level work of democracy in this country, because for a couple of hundred years, they've been doing it fairly well, and we think they will do it fairly well again. We just need to give them a little help and a little bolstering and a little optimism.
And so regarding the transition now, I mean, you're part of the Transition Integrity Project that's also done the same simulations to try and be prepared for all eventualities. First of all, does it matter actually, practically speaking, does it matter at all if President Trump does or doesn't give a concession speech?
Not really in the practical sense, but I will say this. One of the things we simulated was, and remember, there were hardcore Republicans playing the Trump team in these simulations, this very scenario where there'd be a relatively clear victory in the both the popular vote and the Electoral College, and there would be some 70 plus days for the Trump team to wreak havoc. And I'm waiting. I'm waiting with bated breath in some respects because some of it has already started. The release of people from second and third tier levels in the government, the packing of the government with political appointees turned into civil servants. I know all about that. Dick Cheney did it to the tune of about 1,800 people. So it started already, and it could get a lot worse. Our simulation showed that it got a lot worse, a great deal worse, as the Trump team, so to speak, tried to wreak havoc on everything from the White House furniture to any kind of budget they could get their hands on to put in the Secret Service in every Trump hotel across the world for the duration of the days.
And if some of those, even some of those things happened, what impact would it have?
It would have tremendous impact on the transition as dictated by law. And a lot of this is dictated by law, but Trump has already shown a particular disdain for the law. And by that, I mean the new team coming in, the reason we have these long transitions is because we are a superpower, because we have 800 bases across the globe, because we are an empire. And running that empire is no easy thing. And so we have this transition so that the new members coming in can look at the policy papers, look at the sanctions list, look at the state list of terrorists, look at all the things that the administration in power has done, and then make up their own minds as to whether they're going to continue it, whether they're going to change it, throw it out, whatever. It's a very, very, very important process. And I'll give you an idea of how important. When we came in 2000, the George W. Bush administration, we weren't allowed by the GAO into the State Department, Powell and myself, and we were the only two, as I recall, that first day until 20 December. We effectively had about 30 days to transition. And I think one of the reasons we missed the Al-Qaeda emphasis by people like Dick Clark and others and didn't have a National Security Council meeting that included Al-Qaeda until August of that year, and the terrorist attacks occurred the next month, of course. I think that was part of the problem, the short, truncated transition where we didn't have a chance to get real briefings, solid briefings from the outgoing administration. And if Trump were to prevent that or some way make it truncated or some way make it not as efficient and effective as it should be, then Biden would be at a loss, and it's not a time in our history for a president assuming office to be at any loss at all.
Huh. And we're already seeing, I mean, I have to say one thing about this election, Colonel Wilkerson, is that I think it's been an opportunity for we regular citizens to get truly educated on the sort of previously hidden intricacies of the operations of the United States government,
yes.
Right? I mean, for example,
yes.
There's I bet you a lot of people didn't know until this weekend that the General Services Administration, the administrator there has to formally sign off on the beginning stages of the official transfer of power, the official transition. That person is a presidential appointee. And in this case, it's Emily Murphy, appointed by President Trump. And that hasn't gone entirely smoothly yet either. I mean, is that something?
We couldn't get the keys to the Harry Truman Building until 20 December. So we couldn't even go into our future spaces.
Huh. Wow. Okay. So Colonel Wilkerson, stand by here, because there's more that I want to talk about the transition in just a couple of minutes. But let me now turn to Michael Cruz. He's joining us from Davidson, North Carolina. He's senior staff writer at Politico and Politico Magazine. And he has written profiles, many of profiles on presidential candidates. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Magna. Good to be with you.
So first of all, tell us, just to turn the focus back to President-elect Joe Biden here for a minute, how much of what we heard from him on Saturday is basically the heart and soul of the message that he ran with for the past 2 years. And in a sense, how much of it is an endorsement of his original vision of why he wanted to run for president?
For all of the ups and downs of this seemingly interminable campaign cycle, Biden's message was nothing if not consistent. Tony Blinken, a longtime Biden aide, possible Secretary of State, possible National Security Advisor, a certainty to be a key figure in the Biden administration, told me that this is almost a faded meeting of the man in the moment. Joe Biden, what has made him almost fade into a position where he's just sort of part of the furniture of the Senate for 3.5 decades, decency, competency, normalcy, even almost a boringness, made him in some sense just what the moment demanded here after these last 4 or 5 years. His message has been to, as he put it on Saturday night, lower the temperature. And I think that is why he was able to prevail in the way that he did.
Mm. And what's your take, Michael, on whether the actual election, let's just focus on this year, has made that task, that hope of President-elect Biden's that much harder?
He is looking at a situation in which almost definitely he will not have a Democratic-controlled Senate. Obviously, the loss of Trump does not eliminate the divisions that have been so much at the forefront these last few years. So he's going to have to marshal all of these skills for the last few decades to make headway and to lower that temperature.
Well, Michael Cruz and Colonel Larry Wilkerson, stand by for just a second. We are talking about election 2020. There is a president-elect now, President-elect Joe Biden, but whether and how the election itself either strengthened or weakened people's faith in our very democracy. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today we're talking about the long-term impact of election 2020. President-elect Joe Biden made a speech on Saturday after his victory was called, and here he is speaking from Wilmington, Delaware.
I sought this office to restore the soul of America, to rebuild the backbone of this nation, the middle class, and to make America respected around the world again, and to unite us here at home. It's the honor of my lifetime that so many millions of Americans have voted for that vision. And now the work of making that vision is real. It's a task, the task of our time.
President-elect Joe Biden on Saturday. Now, I want to share one more thing here. This is Representative Jim Clyburn of South Carolina, a very strong supporter of the president-elect. Yesterday on CNN's State of the Union, Representative Clyburn responded to a question about the fact that President Trump has yet to concede.
This country is bigger than any one person. This democracy is teetering. So it doesn't matter to me whether or not he concedes. What matters to me is whether or not the Republican Party will step up and help us preserve the integrity of this democracy.
Representative Jim Clyburn of South Carolina on CNN yesterday. I'm joined today by Colonel Larry Wilkerson. He is currently at the College of William and Mary, spent more than 30 years in the United States military, including as chief of staff to Colin Powell. And he was also part of two groups, the National Task Force on Election and Crises and the Transition Integrity Project. Michael Cruz also joins us. He's senior staff writer at Politico. And joining us now is Danielle Allen. She is director of Harvard University's Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics and a professor at Harvard University as well. Professor Allen, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Meghna. Great to be here.
So I would like you to almost be play the role of our sort of our physician who's monitoring the health of the democracy of the United States. You heard Representative Clyburn there just yesterday assert that this democracy is teetering. What do you think about that?
There is a lot of good stuff that's happened in the last week that gives us the resources to address what have been ailments and vulnerabilities. Yes, the representative is right to say that we're still at a vulnerable point, but here's the good news. We have the whole electorate in the electorate for the first time ever. So highest turnout in 120 years. But of course, 120 years ago, women weren't in the electorate. So this is the largest portion of the population that has ever voted. And people without college degrees turned out. People of color turned out. Young people turned out. So every vote is a, sort of like a pledge card, a commitment to the peaceful resolution of conflict. So we have 150 million pledge cards that have just been cast to peaceful resolution of conflict. So yes, we have conflict. Yes, as the representative said, the Republicans need to step up. They're invited to share the work of preserving the integrity of our democracy. But we have real resources to draw on, combination of engagement and motivation and those pledge cards.
And so you feel more confident then than perhaps perhaps others do.
I feel excited, honestly. Okay. I truly feel excited. We haven't had this level of engagement in our lifetimes. And so the job now is for leaders from both parties to channel that energy, to direct it in the direction of preserving the integrity of democracy. So yes, I mean, the representative is right, absolutely, to call out an invitation to Republicans to meet the moment by shoring up the integrity of our democracy. We need Republican leaders and officials to do that. It's really important that they do. If they are able to do that, then we really stand the chance of taking the health of our democracy forward in a powerful and profound way.
Okay, so I would like to hear from all three of you on exactly this point, that ensuring the health and well-being and, in fact, hopefully having our democracy thrive requires a good faith effort amongst all, regardless of party. So to that point, first of all, let me just play Republican Senator Roy Blunt from Missouri. He would not acknowledge that Joe Biden won the presidential election while Blunt was on ABC News yesterday. He said he first wanted to hear from President Trump's lawyers and ensure that every state has finalized their vote counts.
It's going to be much easier to work toward the kind of transition we want. Look at the inauguration, which I'm going to have the honor of chairing again this time, and bringing the country together if everybody feels like we went through a process and everybody was heard.
That's Republican Senator Roy Blunt from Missouri yesterday. On Thursday, Senator Lindsey Graham, who won re-election in South Carolina, he told Fox News' Sean Hannity that he's focusing on raising money for President Trump's legal battles.
I'm going to donate $500,000 tonight to President Trump's defense legal fund, so we'll have the resources to fight. The allegations of wrongdoing are earth-shattering. Senate Republicans are going to be briefed by the Trump campaign Saturday, and every Senate Republican and House Republican needs to get on television and tell this story.
That's Senator Lindsey Graham on Fox on Thursday. Now, Daniel Allen and Michael Cruz and Colonel Wilkerson, I want to hear the three of you sort of talk through this important part of the puzzle in terms of the health of the U.S. of American democracy. So I'm more than happy to step back here for a second, but I'll just turn to you, Colonel Wilkerson, to start. In the in the scenarios that you played out with the Transition Integrity Project, how much did the behavior, the decisions, the speeches of key Republicans have an influence on how the transition might unfold?
Well, it certainly did, and it did less and less so in a deleterious way, in a negative way, as it became more and more certain that the victory was clinched, which I assume will come somewhere around the end of November when official certifications go in. But let me just say that President Biden summed it up. The work of making that vision real. Those are highfalutin words, as my grandmother used to say. But look at my fellow South Carolinian Lindsey Graham, whom I consider to be a Luddite today. I don't know what's happened to Lindsey. Ray Blunt's remarks weren't so bad. Clyburn's remarks, another South Carolinian, I'm a South Carolinian too, as I said, weren't so bad. But I really, really liked what Professor Allen said. I have students in front of me every day. I've had them for 16 years now, who are in that 60 to 65% of the people in this country under 30 who voted for Joe Biden. That's the future. Those are the generations upon which my generation and those around me have put such a colossal burden, from climate crisis to debt, that they ought to have the say in this, and they did have the say in this. And so I'm optimistic in that regard.
Danielle or Michael, just go ahead and jump in.
So I would say that Joe Biden is, if nothing else, an institutionalist. He is a person who was elected to the United States Senate in 1972. He has these, some would say and have said, old-fashioned notions of bipartisanship, of just general Capitol Hill comedy. His relationships in the Senate, particularly in his first couple terms, ran the gamut, including to the residue of segregationist senators from the South. And he has gotten a bunch of criticism about that for the last couple years in this never-ending presidential campaign. But I actually think now it is something he can draw on to try to build that bridge, not only to the other side of the political aisle, in particular with the Senate in mind, but also build a bridge. He pitched himself as such, as a bridge to, as Colonel Wilkerson was saying, to the next generation. I think he is, in some strange but undeniable way, in a unique position to try to build these kinds of bridges, and he has to, he has to, if we are to move forward at this still very, very riven moment in our nation's history.
So I would point to the question of what happens to the Republican Party as really at issue here. I mean, we've watched people like Lindsey Graham make a complete about face with regard to their descriptions of Donald Trump, their relationships to him. To some extent, that is explained in a very straightforward way as the operation of power. The president has been exceptionally powerful. He carries a base with him. His Republican colleagues needed him to carry their own elections. So that's, I think, where they're stuck to some extent. They're looking at his 70 million voters, and those voters do need engagement, and they need to be part of the political conversation. The question is, can other people start to engage them in productive ways? And in that regard, sort of release the hold of Trump himself. To some extent, his hold, I think, will weaken simply because power is shifting away from him. The process by which elections are called by our journalistic organizations goes back to the middle of the 19th century. So it rests on longstanding precedent. It's got durability. It matters that Fox and the Wall Street Journal made their calls at the same time as everybody else. So I think that we have broad cross-ideological consensus around what the situation is, what the facts are. And that is, I think, going to pull the ground out from underneath President Trump.
So, so
in that regard, I do see a shift coming.
Professor Allen, I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but what the three of you have said has really, this is where my mind ends up getting focused when it comes to understanding American democracy. Because yes, there are written into the rule of law important dates, important functions, important essential acts that happen to keep our democracy going, right? To have elections and transitions of power. All of those things are absolutely critical for us to understand and to allow them to operate without interference. And at the same time, if we have learned anything over the past several years, it's that the belief of the people, the demos of democracy in those very institutions, in those very laws, that's my awkward metaphor, but like that's almost like the oil that keeps the engine running smoothly, right? And so, Professor Allen, let me just turn back to you quickly on this. Of those 71 million Americans who voted for President Trump, even if half of them refuse to believe in the integrity and legitimacy of this election or the integrity and legitimacy of President-elect Joe Biden's victory, what impact does that have on our democracy as a whole?
It's a blow, without any question. It's a blow. And then there is a lot of work for the rest of us to heal in relationship to that injury, that harm. And so I do think we'll need over the next few years all of our institutions to pull together to secure the integrity. I do think that the secretaries of state around the country and governors have been exemplary in this situation. And we can expand out from there to really build a broad network for securing the integrity of our system.
Colonel Wilkerson, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that's basically true. I was just looking at the list I got off the net this morning. Republicans own 29 state legislatures, Democrats 19. That's an overwhelming advantage. Minnesota's split, of course, Nebraska nonpartisan, so that takes you to 50. And yet we got this cooperation. And when I watch, for example, people in Pennsylvania, Republicans, talk about they would not accept anything but the correct procedures in their state for counting ballots, for casting ballots, for looking at provisional ballots and so forth. So even when they themselves or Republicans like them had limited their ability to do it swiftly by not allowing them to count the huge amount of mail-in votes, for example, until the night of the election. When I watched this happen, I said, well, things are working the way they should work. And so I share in that optimism. But let me quickly say that most political scientists, political theorists worth their salt would tell you that a democracy that's split 50-50 is well nigh impossible to govern. Mm. So that's going to be Biden's challenge. If he can deal with that and he can make some progress, then he will be a great president.
And Michael, is that made more difficult by the tensions, let's be frank, within the Democratic Party itself? I mean, it was almost instantaneous after Saturday that we saw those tensions kind of erupt out into the public between some of the key, most high-profile members of the progressive left and others in the more sort of moderate wing of the party.
There's no question. This is something that Joe Biden has had to deal with, certainly in the general election portion of this campaign. To some extent, he had to deal with less than he might have simply because even the left acknowledged the importance of the loss of Donald Trump to lessen, at least lessen, not eliminate, but lessen the stress test that democracy has been feeling. I think in some weird way, it will not be as much as it might have been had Democrats taken control of the Senate. And granted, we still have to watch what happens in Georgia. Perhaps we're looking at a different scenario come January. But the reality of the situation is President Joe Biden, January 20th on, is going to have to try to address the division, the larger divisions in the country, as much as or more than he's going to have to address the divisions within his own party. Those are there. They always have been there, and they will continue to be there, presumably, in particular, as the younger generation gets older and continues to be hopefully more and more politically active and engaged. This is a pretty progressive age group, pretty liberal age group coming up.
Yeah, and to your point, I mean, democracies are always fractious, right? That isn't differences of opinion and goals isn't necessarily the problem. The problem is when the fight becomes overwhelming, right? And no consensus emerges whatsoever. I mean, to Colonel Wilkerson's point about things becoming ungovernable. Michael, just to give you one last quick thought here before we have to take another break. I mean, is that something that the Biden camp has to consider?
So President-elect Biden always has believed that when you get right down to it, politics is about face-to-face relationships, is about personal relationships. And maybe that applies, and maybe it applies less than it once did. But that is the way he always has done it, and that is the way he's going to do it. Moving forward, he is, for better or for worse, the kind of longtime politician who could have conversations with Mitch McConnell and with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and he will.
Well, Michael Cruz, senior staff writer at Politico and Politico Magazine, thank you, Michael, for joining us.
Thanks so much.
And Colonel Larry Wilkerson, distinguished adjunct professor at the College of William and Mary, served for more than 30 years in the United States military. Colonel Wilkerson, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Magna.
And Professor Allen, stand by. When we come back, I want to get more of your prescription for strengthening American democracy as we go forward. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today we're talking not just about the election of now President-elect Joe Biden to the White House, but also the long-term impact on American democracy of election 2020. I'm joined today by Danielle Allen. She's the director of Harvard University's Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics, one of the nation's foremost scholars on democracy and democratic governments. And, you know, we must note, we haven't noted it yet, so, but we must note that we now have a new vice president elect as well, Kamala Harris, a woman of many firsts for this nation. And when she spoke on Saturday, she invoked the late Congressman John Lewis.
Congressman John Lewis, before his passing, wrote, "Democracy is not a state. It is an act." And what he meant was that America's democracy is not guaranteed. It is only as strong as our willingness to fight for it.
That's Vice President-elect Kamala Harris on Saturday. So democracy is an act, and many, many historic number of voters participated in that act this year, as did people who worked at the polls. 35-year-old Elizabeth Saunders served 5 years in the U.S. Navy. Last Tuesday, she served her country again by being a poll worker in Tulsa, Oklahoma, specifically Precinct 24 in North Tulsa.
As a veteran, I don't really care who you were voting for, just that you are there showing up to actually engage in, you know, your civic duty to have your say in how this country is run.
Now, this was Elizabeth's second stint as a poll worker. So, Professor Allen, just listen along with us a little bit, because Elizabeth told us that when she walked into the Sheridan Avenue United Methodist Church at 6:30 in the morning on Election Day, she's the first to admit she was actually pretty nervous.
It was really exciting for me to see such a huge increase in first-time voters in Tulsa. Some of them were 18 and it was the first time they could vote. Some of them were 60 and it was the first time they've chosen to vote. We had a girl who came in with her parents and they were just so excited to help her vote for the first time, and they were cheering and clapping, and that was exciting for everybody who was there. I really expected it to be a very kind of day fraught with a lot of anxiety and a lot of maybe harsh conversations while we were working. As a veteran, I am comfortable around weapons, but I'm not used to living somewhere it's an open carry state. And I know you can't carry guns to the polls. However, we were in a church room with no windows, so we didn't know what was on the outside of the door when we had to go do our perimeter check or our walk around, just to make sure that people who were in line were being treated properly and that there was no one intimidating voters and that kind of thing. Fortunately, we never had any issues with that, but you don't know what's on the other side of the door when there's no windows. So, you know, when someone would go out to do the check, you know, it was just keeping an eye, making sure that, hey, you know, if you're not back in a few minutes, we're going to come check on you. What's on the other side of the door? When we first opened the polls at 7 a.m., it was obvious the ballot counting machine that sits on top of our ballot box was not working right. And so there's provisions for that, which is there's an emergency ballot box that you can put the ballot into. It's secure. Nobody can get into that. We were instructing people to just deposit their ballots into that box while we waited for a technician to come out. And a woman and her husband came in, and when they got those directions, they just got really upset, saying, my vote's not going to count. You're not going to count my vote. This isn't okay. Have you told everybody that the machine's not working? You have to inform people. She got very, very emotional about whether or not her vote was going to count and whether or not everyone who had voted before her was going to count. Just for me, it was very hard because I'm kind of a very security conscious person, and, you know, having some security training, you look for the indicators that something might become a heightened event. And what does that one person who's upset then turns into two, turns into three? And in the social media world, you know, that could be a really hostile situation very quickly. So I think a larger problem is the education system we currently have, which is teaching people that there's only one answer to a multiple choice test. We don't teach people how to have a discussion and how to engage in a dialogue. And that problem is going to persist until the education system changes. And that carries into political conversations where there's only one right answer for a candidate. It's not that we can have a discussion about topics and issues. And I think until we can solve that problem, we're going to continue to see a lot of the things that we've seen over the past few months in this country.
That's Elizabeth Saunders. She served for 5 years in the United States Navy and also as a poll worker in the past two elections in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Well, Professor Allen, I think Elizabeth is getting to sort of the deeper layers of what we need to be thinking about here, that it's not just about election 2020 or how anyone cast their particular vote this time around, but something deeper about how we as individuals learn about this nation, how we view each other. So what's your response to her idea that we actually need to more deeply educate folks about our democracy?
Absolutely. There's a lot to say there. And that was really wonderful to listen to, Elizabeth. Those were beautiful reflections. And they made me think, too, of I asked some of our local election officials last week about whether or not retired folks who often are poll workers were, you know, in fewer numbers this year because of the pandemic. And I was so surprised and moved to learn that not at all, actually. Even people who have retirement age who are working as poll workers were there ready to do their job. And so I think the duty and dedication that we've seen exhibited in the last week should move us all to a new place to rebuild the foundations for our civic education. There are things that we can do in our education system. There are things that we can do by reforming our political institutions to function better and give us all a better opportunity for participation.
So let's talk about that, right? Because we had you on this summer when a major commission that you helped lead put out a big report called Our Common Purpose, Reinventing American Democracy for the 21st Century. And this seems to be the perfect moment to revisit that. First of all, can you point to me to the one or there were a lot of findings in that report, but now with election 2020 and how it played out, where would you focus a Biden administration's efforts on reinventing American democracy?
Well, for me, it's really important that people recognize that this is not a silver bullet kind of conversation. I can't tell you, here's the one thing to do. It always takes work on our institutions to reform them so that they're responsive, on our civil society so that we invest in the kinds of organizations that help each other bridge differences. And it takes work in our culture, too, so that we can rebuild that sense of mutual commitment to one another. You know, that sort of call of President-elect Biden's to give each other a chance. So we really have to do all three things. I do think expanding the size of the House of Representatives is critical, and that would affect the Electoral College. It would help us rebalance what is now a quite dramatic skew between the rural and less populated parts of the country and urban populated portions of the country. So I would point to that in the institutional space. With regard to civil society, we need to do so much better a job of filling the news deserts that we have at the local level, where we don't really cover city politics anymore. We don't even really cover state politics always necessarily so well. And then people are not connected to their own choices because they're not getting the information they need. So we have to do work on a media ecosystem that supports that broad education. And then for our culture, you know, we have to work to find a way to tell a shared history. It's really amazing to me that we're fighting so much over the question of who and what we are as Americans. How can we tell a story that both is clear-eyed about where this country has gone wrong, the harms of enslavement and Native American removal and genocide, but also the accomplishments, the achievements, the invention of a structure for free self-government among free and equal citizens. So that all three kinds of work are incredibly important for our future.
And none of it's going to be easy, right? Let's not joke ourselves. None of it's going to be easy. Because, in fact, I wonder if in terms of certain recommendations that you and your fellow scholars put forth in that report regarding what we need to do to modernize and really make American democracy even more resilient, some of those recommendations I'm not even sure maybe Americans themselves want. Let's give an example. Both you and I are sitting here in the state of Massachusetts that also last week had a voter referendum on ranked choice voting, right? Which was one of the recommendations out of your report from this summer. And it lost. The voters voted against ranked choice voting. So what does that tell you?
It's true, but for me, what it tells me is that those of us who are advocates for ranked choice voting didn't build our campaign in the right way. When you look at the results from that campaign, we did very well in more affluent suburbs and towns and places with a high percentage of people with college degrees. We did less well in places where the percentage of college degrees is lower, for example. And for me, this is a perfect reflection of our national politics. We have two different ecosystems of communication, two different sort of social networks operating. And we made the mistake of sort of campaigning from our comfort place, from where we are. We were a group of people who come from sort of that background of college educated and so forth. And I think it really is time for people like me to get out and start even our campaigning differently in conversations in places that are less familiar to us. So I think that's really, for me, the lesson of what happened with the ranked choice voting campaign in Massachusetts. Mm.
So in the last 5 minutes or so that we have, Professor Allen, I wonder if we could really take a big step back here, because you're a scholar of democracies. You've written extensively, for example, on the Declaration of Independence. I mean, put election 2020 where you think it belongs, sort of in this grand historical arc of moments when the United States, the people of the United States, had the opportunity to decide what kind of country they wanted to be over the next 4 years.
This is it. This is the first true beginning. I am an incredible admirer of the work done at the founding, 1776, 1787, 88, 89, and so forth. Yet this election is the first one that has truly energized the whole electorate, people from all backgrounds. And so now we have the hard work of converting that energy and engagement and motivation into a healthy, functioning constitutional democracy. Our public sphere is loud, it's full of argument and contention, but that's because everybody is in the public sphere. So 50, 60 years ago, people of color still were not actively participating. People without college degrees were not actively participating in the public sphere. So it was quieter and it felt perhaps more civil, but that's partly because there were so many voices that weren't in the public sphere. So we have this incredible, gorgeous opportunity to deliver the promise of equality, liberty, and justice for all that has been the proposition at the heart of this country's life.
How much does it matter, though, that it seems as if this historic mobilization of the American people was around not sort of an affirmative vision for what they want the country to be for many of them? Does that matter, that it seems as if many people, whether they voted for the president-elect or whether they voted for President Trump, were motivated by almost a negative purpose in casting their ballot?
I do think it's important that the president-elect has a sort of a teaching job to do. In his speech Saturday, he said, choose unity. Choose unity. And no, we are not by any measure there as a people yet. And he has a lot of work to do to bring people around to understanding what it means even to choose unity, what kind of commitment to one another. But I do think it's truly possible. I think what we've seen on the side of the folks who voted for Trump is here's a person who went out, he held rallies all over the country. He connected with people, he listened to them. He used a sort of call and response method to build his own agenda. He'd sort of shout out whatever was on his mind, and then the things that sort of got a reaction he tended to build on. And so in that regard, the folks who came into the electorate in response to Donald Trump did so only in relationship, honestly, to a pretty narrow agenda offering, okay? Only what was in Donald Trump's mind was put before them as a possibility. So I think the lesson there is it's time for every politician, Democrats as well, to get out to those audiences and listen and widen the agenda of possibilities being shared and discussed. And yes, this is hard work in reforming Congress, reforming our voting systems, bringing in something even perhaps like universal voting, investing in local news, really hard work. Mm-hmm. And there it matters to recognize that being a member of a free self-governing people, being one of among free and equal citizens is work. There is an element of duty to it and a concept of service. And we all do need to rebuild that notion that with our freedom, with our equality comes an obligation of service.
Last question, because I always feel very inspired in hearing you speak, Professor Allen, but I also want to just inject a little bit of, I don't know, cynicism, realism here, because there are many, there's a lot of money, there's ideologies that are very organized in opposition to exactly the kinds of things you're talking about in terms of modernizing our democracy.
Yes, no, there's no question about it. And we struggle with issues of campaign finance, but this is honestly where I do come back to ranked choice voting as something that's incredibly important. And I do hope to be able to get out and to talk more in places that are new to me about the idea and explore it with people, because what it really does is incentivize candidates to be problem solvers, to campaign to the middle, and to, in fact, be able to put aside narrow interests of portions of the electorate or specific lobbyists. So I really do think we have to work still on our electoral mechanisms as a part of fighting back against those powerful interests.
Well, Danielle Allen, she's director of Harvard University's Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics, amongst many other accolades she deserves. Professor Allen, thank you as always for joining us.
Thank you so much, Meghna.
Well, tomorrow, folks, we're going to take the global view of what election 2020 meant to people around the world. So if you listen to On Point from abroad, what did you see in this past week? Give us a call at 617-353-0680. 1-800-273-8683. That's 617-353-0683. We want the global view of election 2020. I'm Megan Chakrabarty. This is On Point.